You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, and today we have a very special episode. We're talking with one of my favorite bands, and not only one of my favorite bands, some of the most interesting people in music there is. We're talking with Eugene Robinson, singer of Oxbow. Eugene, how you doing?
Not too bad. How you doing, John? Gentilly?
Doing real good. Doing real good. It's always good to talk to
Eugene. I've been practicing saying your last name.
Eugene, you're doing a great job. Sometimes people say Gentile, but Eugene said it in the correct Italian accent, Gentilly or Gentilly, as Eugene suggests. So, actually, Eugene's a real interesting guy. The first time, and we're going to talk about Nico in a second. Nico's here too. He's the guitar / multi-instrumentalist behind Oxbow as well. Eugene's a super interesting guy. And the first time that I met Eugene, I was interviewing, I can't remember what it was. It might have been about maybe a narcotic story for Oxbow or something. And I drove out. He said, well, meet me at this location. So I went to the location, and it was a MMA club or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu club. And you said, well, I'm going to practice, and then you can interview me afterwards. And he puts the Bad Brains on a CD player, and he whips this guy's ass. And then we go outside, and he's got, it was like a Dodge Charger or something, like some muscle car from the 70s.
You remember
what car that was? Chevy. Was
Chevelle.
It a Nova?
No, Chevelle.
There's this big junkyard dog in the backseat that he lets out. And then Eugene just talked about everything from MMA to Oxbow to delivering, I guess, health food to Allen Ginsberg or somebody like that in New York. Was it Allen Ginsberg or?
No, that was Andy Warhol.
Andy Warhol, even better. And Eugene's a character because Eugene will say, oh, I delivered food to Andy Warhol, or I was in a Bill Cosby movie, or I'm on the back of SSD Control's first album or whatever. And you say, there is no way that this guy hasn't been involved in this many things. I'm sure he's bullshitting. And then there's photographic evidence for all of it, particularly the most recent Eugene. I don't want to say Eugene shenanigans, but it's some destruction around Eugene and then the company that he used to work for. Is under investigation, I guess, by the SEC or whatever for committing
Justice Department, SEC, as well as the IRS. Yeah, that was great. That's a great story.
So Eugene has written quite extensively about this on his Substack and some other places about how he used to work for this company called OZ Media and how his writing was great, but the boss was a real piece of work, and it's great to see the boss get his comeuppance, or hopefully get his comeuppance. So anyways, Eugene is one of the most fascinating people I've met in music ever. Eugene, thanks for being on the show. And so thanks again. Anyway, Nico, I haven't really met Nico that much before. I'm well aware of Nico's works. Nico was in Whipping Boy, which was, I guess, a different band than Oxbow, but I guess you could say Oxbow spawned out of Whipping Boy, or a product spawned out of Whipping Boy that eventually formed into Oxbow. Nico is an amazing multi-instrumentalist, and one of the amazing things about Nico is not only does he put together all these amazingly disparate genres and sounds, but I was reading a bunch of interviews with him. Nico is the most, I guess, mysterious when it comes to what he does outside Oxbow. Nico always just says, oh, I do other non-music things. So, Nico, is that by design, or is that just because you don't like talking about what you do outside of Oxbow?
I've been selling software for a really long time. And in the Bay Area, that means working with tech companies to sell stuff. The last thing I was doing was selling. See, are you bored yet? See, you start looking at your computer, it's like, why the hell are we talking about this?
No, I'm selling operating systems. With your software. So the very interesting thing about Oxbow is I think another member, the animatronics for Hollywood movies or something, all the guys in Oxbow are very educated, very intellectual, very interesting people. And I think that's why the music is so rad. Anyways, so that's what we're here to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about some other things. But Oxbow has a new album coming out. The new album is called Lover's Holiday, or Love's Holiday.
Love's Holiday
out July 22nd via Ipecac. One of the things about Oxbow is everyone says, you know, they're noise rock, or they're post-rock, or they're post-punk, or they're avant-garde. The new record, I like the record a whole lot. But to me, I just thought it was very listenable. And I mean that as a compliment, in that it's daring, it's interesting, but it's very listenable to me. I mean, is that by design, or is that just how everything, just how, you know what I mean? I didn't feel like, if you listen to like John Cage, or if you listen to, you know, even like some Frank Zappa stuff, you're like, oh, he's trying to make me work for the music. But I don't feel like I had to work with it. I feel like I could just enjoy it. You know what I'm saying? So
I think is that by design? We tortured our audience for 30 years, and now we're trying to give people a break.
This is the payoff. This is like if you stuck with us this long, this is our present to you, you know.
The concept of Love's Holiday actually goes back almost 15 years, because in 2008 or 2009, you guys did a live show with Justin Broderick of Napalm Death and Godflesh, and that was called the Love's Holiday Orchestra. I mean, is there a connecting theme here, or was that just a good name to reuse?
Well, there had been this idea, right? And I started thinking about it a few years ago, and I was not communicating well, or as well as I usually do when we're talking about it. But I was trying to underscore in a certain way that people who are angry forever are emotionally stunted, and we're not emotionally stunted. You know, like the music that we made in 87 should be different from the music we're making now. And so I had this whole idea that I wanted to do something really plangent and like quiet. And I mean, because my mood, the fuckfest mood, is not the mood that I haven't been in that headspace for the last 5 years. Things evolve. And so Nico and I were going to do this. We're going to do this side project. We're going to call it a project off of the project. And we said, okay, well, let's call it Love's Holiday. And the Justin Broderick, Dave Cochran, Stephen O'Malley thing was just a way for us to use that name to kind of sit on it so nobody else grabbed a hold of it. But as you know, we start talking to the rest of the band about it, and it just, I couldn't really commute. I mean, what I was trying to get around was like, at some point, my ideal is to leave the stage with my clothes on and not having to wring them out into a cup. You know, and I wasn't saying like I mind that, but performatively, if it's a conversation that we're having with the audience, I don't want to be the same guy talking about the same thing. Like Rollins talks about it. He goes, yeah, you know, you have the music, or the music doesn't have you. I wish he had stuck with it and tried to figure out how to make music that grabbed him at 40 and at 45 and at 50 and at 55. I think that would have been really interesting. But that's, I think, kind of what, where we were getting our heads around with the whole Love's Holiday thing. We're going to do something different. And I think Nico, along with Joe Ciccarelli, who did all of the production, Nico and Joe actually managed to really like embrace that and deliver it. You know, it takes a lot of complexity to be simple. And I think they did a fantastic job of delivering on our desire to change the conversation just a little bit.
Can we talk for just a second about the fantasy world where somebody, maybe it was Rollins, drags Greg Ginn into the future that we want? You know, he should do whatever he wants. Because I still, when you go back and listen, obviously, everybody knows this, but I'm just restating the obvious. When you listen to old Black Flag, there's amazing shit going on musically. It's really difficult to mimic that. It's really heavy. It's super intense. Obviously, what if they did what you're saying, Eugene? You know, and I haven't listened to Greg for a while. You know, the politics, whatever, the social stuff, but the music. Yeah, that's an interesting idea.
Yeah. Well, you know, I hate to say this, and this is going to veer a little bit off, but Kurt, you know, the algorithm has fed me some stuff that I wouldn't have listened to ordinarily. And that last Black Flag record, What The, that everybody made fun of because it was so horrible. That record is not fucking horrible. It's actually really good. The artwork is horrible. But I listened to that record and I was like, I was an asshole for listening to people. It's actually not a bad record at all. This is the record they did about 4 years ago, I think. Terrible.
Who else?
Mike Vallely was singing. And you know, a rhythm section of guys that he put together, but I thought it was gonna be like
Mike doesn't sing on What The. What does Ron Reyes?
Ron Reyes sings on What The?
Yes.
Okay, that's right. You're right. He's great. It's a solid record. The artwork is terrible. Artwork is absolutely terrible. But I've listened to the record 4 or 5 times since I just made this discovery about 6 days ago. I feel the record was unjustly maligned. No.
I need to check it out then.
Yep.
I think it's decent. I wish, see, Greg used to be the, and I promise we'll get back to Oxford. This, and I love to, I'll talk about Black Flag for hours and hours. But with what the, is Greg, you be the master of attack and space and like letting, like Greg attacks and then Greg attacks and then, I mean, Greg attacks, then Chuck attacks, then Keith attacks. Whereas on what the, he just grinds a riff over and over and over. I wish he had given Ron Reyes more space. And I feel like could have been an incredible record, but Ron again just grinds out a riff over and over and over. That's my perspective.
Yeah.
But anyways, anyway, we're not talking about, actually, if the listeners want a deep reference, Eugene very briefly was in a Black Flag spinoff band called Black Face with Chuck Dukowski, where they recorded two unreleased Chuck Dukowski, I think mid-80s era Black Flags, which you should check out that 7-inch if you can find it. But anyways, we're talking about Love's Holiday. Nico, one thing that I really enjoyed on this record was how you, like, there's a lot of tension, particularly on like the second half of the record where the songs are maybe a little bit slower. There's like this, there's like this building and this grind. And my question is, do you approach music, I guess, from a primal angle, that like I'm going to make a noise here and then I'm going to, you know, make a squeal here? Or do you look at it, I guess, like a music instructor and they're like, oh, this is an elevated third or whatever and so forth? How do you construct music?
Interesting. I once read Frank Zappa, somebody talking about working with Zappa. As you know, Joe Ciccarelli, the guy we're making records with, was one of Zappa's engineers for about 5 years or something. So we actually have a friend who knew Frank Zappa. In any case, and Zappa would say things in his scores. He'd write out a super complicated score and at some point write text of make a jazz noise here. You know, this is the improvisatory. This is the John Cage. But, you know, that's valid. And in a way, that's part of it for me as well. It doesn't really matter what you do if it gets across this idea. There's a lot of intuitive shit going on, but then at some point it's helpful to understand what that is. Is that a minor nine? Yeah. Oh, that would be interesting to, you know, it can get, knowing the theory behind it can get you out of the corner that you paint yourself into. But in general, I'm not trying to hit the 13ths and the sharp nines. That's just what I want to hear.
One interesting theme that runs through the record is the concept of love. And love has been, you know, I think in the modern era, it's a malign topic. Like, if you just come out with like a love song, you're cheesy or saccharine. Whereas in like, you know, the 50s and 60s and even 70s, you know, most songs on the radio were love. Eugene has an interesting quote here. I'm trying to, I can dig it up real quick. Let's see here. Eugene says, oh, I lost track of it. It's where Eugene says he wants to be like a Teddy Pendergrass or something, or he sees himself like a Barry White or Teddy Pendergrass or something like that. Where Eugene, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, when you first started getting into music, you were into like disco, soul, funk, and R&B until you were gifted Life on the Line by Eddie and the Hot Rods, correct?
Teenage Depression. Eddie and the Hot Rods. Yeah. So that was 77.
So anyways, do you guys feel as though that I mean, so why approach love? I mean, Eugene's been talking about how you guys are in different mindsets than you were, say, 1988, 1989. Love, I mean, are you guys attacking it from a genuine standpoint or a dead-on standpoint? Like, Sinatra might sing like a love song?
No, I wouldn't use the word attacking, even in this context. I think that insofar as the records have lyrically have documented our life and times, after the cycle that goes from Fuckfest to Thin Black Duke, we decided to do something completely different. We didn't decide, it just happened, where those guys were generating songs with the expectation of doing a record. And I usually have lyrics already written. I had nothing. In fact, it was like terra incognito. I did not know where it was going to go. And I knew what we had done is not what I wanted to do. So I started listening to the music to see if I also thought that was hopeless. And the music was not hopeless at all. It motivated me to, a lot of those lyrics were written with me at practice, listening to the songs over and over and over again, which is not different from any other record, but usually any other record, I have lyrics already. And so I think I wrote the lion's share of those lyrics from the music. The music motivated the lyrics. With 21 songs, maybe 21 lyrics. And Nico and Joe are the ones who decided which ones were actually going to go on the record, you know, on Love's Holiday, and the order. And then after that, I kind of read the lyrics and I go, you know, an image is exerting itself from the mist. And the image is kind of where my head has been the last 10 years lyrically with, you know, a meditation on love, because most people who write about it, write about the first portion of it, or they write about the last portion of it. You know, they don't write about, you know, and I don't think they write about in any really honest way, either the first or the last part, and certainly not the middle stuff, you know. And no matter, and I mean, if you take away nothing from this, no matter how good it is, no matter how good it is, given the nature of finitude and mortality, it's going to end no matter what. In fact, the better it is, the worse the ending is to consider, you know. So how do you get yourself to deal with these kind of existential exit issues, which are completely not on the menu for somebody who's 19, right? It wouldn't be on my menu when I was 19. So it's sort of a miracle that it happened that way, but it lines up directly with how the lyrics have played out before, telling a very distinct story. But in this instance, we just threw a bunch of stuff out there, and in the final analysis, it still told the story of meditating love in a very honest and direct way, you know, like with the line off of 1,000 Hours when I sing, you know, I love you too much. I mean, I don't think you have a more honest or more menacing lyric in any of the musical canon that I've listened to, you know. But if anything, you know, like I was talking about Nick Cave the other day, and I sort of feel like about half of his stuff, I always feel like he's putting me on, but I always feel that way. Like I feel that way, like about Mick Jagger. I feel like lyrically, he's kind of like putting me on. Like it's like some kind of, and what I've hoped to do with the lyrics and the presentation and the vocalizing is to let you know that I'm not fucking putting you on at all. I'm speaking to you as directly as it's humanly possible for me to speak to you. And if nothing, you should take away that. So
I mean, Eugene, you've just described a very, I guess, objective analysis of love from beginning to end, or at least focusing on the middle. I mean, where are you at right now? Are you like Paul McCartney? Do you love love? Are you angry at love? I mean, where do you stand? Is that too simplistic of a question? You know, do we mean romantic love, or do we mean like human love? You know what I mean?
I mean erotic love. Like I'm not talking about philia or agape, or I'm talking about, you know, the kind of love that comes between lovers, right? And it is an enterprise that's it's like you know, if you think about your relationship like it's a tiger, you will do much better with your relationship. You know, I mean, you can have a comfortable existence with a tiger, but never forget for a second that this tiger is extremely dangerous, you know? So, but yeah, I mean, you know, it documents my divorce as well as my, you know, remarriage, and all in all, I think I'm an optimist. But even as much of an optimist as I am, you know, this movie only ends one way, man. That's with all of us dead. So,
Nico, do you think Eugene's perception or analysis of love is optimistic or pessimistic? And that, like, I mean, to me, it seems kind of pessimistic, I'll say, because, you know, Eugene's like, no matter what happens, it ends, which is true. But then, I mean, you could take the, I mean, what's your perspective, Nico, on the concept of love itself?
Undoubtedly, there is a drastic change. We spend our lives wondering what's going to happen, don't we? And then it happens no matter what. We're talking about death here, and it could be nothing. That's generally what I've arrived at for myself. But it's interesting that we're talking about change in Oxbow and change in the recorded output. And we did, you know, this is our 8th record or something, and 7 of those records were all about, for me, love for a for the opposite sex, like love for a particular woman. And the change on this record is thinking differently and paying attention to the other kinds of love. I had two kids within the making of this record. And there's a song on here that's directly related to my mom getting sick and dying, and another song that, in, you know, my father died in the making of this record. So a lot of interest in my mind about what the other kinds of love are, and that being super important. And here's my little girl. So I'm going to wrap up that answer. But I think for sure that things are going to change drastically and probably end in nothingness.
Eugene, I don't know if you want to answer this or not. Nico, it looks like Nico's taking care of something. But Eugene, your concept on, I guess, existence itself, is the end or is not the end? What's the Eugene world of view of the of existence?
I don't know that I should say, because somebody I was talking about the other day and somebody said, oh, man, you're like, you're kind of like the Black Alex Jones. I was like, you know what? maybe I shouldn't talk about this, but no, I believe it's like, okay, John, what did you wear last Tuesday? You remember?
Do I remember what I wore? Well, same thing. I wore a suit earlier on in the day, and then I wore black jeans, a white t-shirt, and then a band t-shirt over top of that, but I can't remember which one.
Wow, good for you.
So you can't remember the t-shirt, right? So right. My prediction is that this life will be like that outfit, right? Once we shed these skin suits, that we become part of this soup of consciousness, and where we don't have any really prevailing sense of I, that sticks with the clothing. And after that, I have no degree of certainty about anything else. So,
well said. Actually, I'm getting a little, I guess, pretentious maybe. So, I mean, Oxbow is a very heavy band. The new album is actually very heavy, very melodic, so daring, definitely. But like I said, not necessarily harsh to my ears. I really enjoyed the record a lot. But the question is, because Oxbow is such a daring heavy band, you guys often get these very heady questions. Do you guys get tired of heady questions? You just want like silly questions sometimes? Or do you guys really enjoy being, we are Oxbow and we are, you know, philosophical and deep?
Oh man, we really do. We think about that stuff all the time. And there's a lot of stupid questions in life. And so we appreciate someone intelligent enough to ask the questions that we're thinking about already, as you say, obviously.
You know, we spent on one tour, we spent about 6 days solid trying to get to the bottom of why murder is wrong, right? Murder, killing. And ultimately, I think it was Greg who hit on this idea that a society that codifies murder as a tool of usefulness, of utility, is an inherently unstable society and therefore fails to do what societies do best, which is to generate more of itself. So it took us 6 days to get to that. And all of us were engaged as we drive around Europe in this van talking about, okay, what about this? What about a soldier? What about a cop? What about self-defense? What about, and so it took us 6 days to get around to not whether murder was good or bad necessarily, get rid of the moral aspect of it, but is it useful? And so it took us 6 days to get to, now it's not really useful from a societal point of view. So this is the kind of stuff we do. So if you want to ask us questions about our underwear or whether we like pickleball or not, that's probably not going to fly.
All right, then let me hit you guys with one more, I guess, high concept question, and then I'll hit you with a practical question. The high concept question is, are human beings like any other animal in that they're trying to reproduce to survive, to further their own species, like an ant or like an algae or like a tree? Or is there something more to the human condition than just trying to make more of oneself?
This is like, you know, I had a longtime girlfriend that was ended up getting a PhD in looking at Roman the point of this is there was a lot of religion classes in an academic setting. And so at some point I was talking about our cat and how I thought that he was very human-like. And the question was, oh man, so you think the cat has a soul? You think there's going to be something left to our panda cat Elijah when he's gone? You know, now I've lost the question. What's the question again?
The question is, are human beings just like any other animal, or is there something more to a human being?
So you're asking if there's a soul.
I suppose I am.
Okay.
Go ahead, Eugene.
Okay, I would say that what we're talking about is consciousness, right? I don't know that I feel comfortable with soul because it's been trammeled by moralist, but I would say consciousness, and I think animals bring consciousness to bear in a very certain and clear way. And not only that, I've had people who have had prior life experience, right? And I don't want to sound Shirley MacLaine-esque about this, but prior life experience of an animal nature, right? I mean, they're processing it through their current present human form, but they were doing things in their understanding of where they were prior to this life that humans don't do. You know, we don't move along the ground without touching the ground very quickly. Birds do that, you know. We don't swim underwater for extended periods of time. You know, ocean creatures do that. So I think consciousness is fungible. And I see humans as being, you know, having no more or less of this than anything else that walks or crawls on this planet.
Okay.
And so if you think that, what do you do with it? You know, does it make sense to eat these other things? You know, where does that go?
Well, they eat each other, right? Like I remember talking to Lola. And I said, would you rather be able to fly or swim underwater? And because I'm thinking, if I swim underwater, all the water on the Earth's surface has no fear for me, right? Like, I'm not afraid of drowning. I can breathe underwater. She goes, no, you kidding? It's a jungle under there. Everything eats everything all the time. If it's bigger than you, it will try to eat you. It's hell. And I go, good point. Never thought of that. I guess I'll pick flying then. So I don't feel, you know, I don't feel bad when I eat a fish.
But you have a choice.
Nico brings up a great thing, and I'm going to segue into the next practical question.
Good. Thank God.
A Love's Holiday is out July 15th. The Ipecac, it is cool. We're going to talk a little
bit
about it.
Why you keep changing the date? It's July 21st.
That's what I mean. Listen, it's coming out real soon. July 21. I am sorry. July 21. Love's Holiday. Great record. Nico, you talked about eating fish, and you said, but we have a choice. That quote is a quote by Morrissey. Morrissey is also produced by Joe Ciccarelli.
Oh, my God.
Last few Morrissey records have had kind of a synth-heavy buzz to them, which was done first by Oxbow. Do you think Morrissey has been influenced by Oxbow?
Absolutely, without a doubt. And the conduit is Ciccarelli. you heard it here first.
I think Nico is maybe making a joke, but I did get a call from Ciccarelli, and he said, hey, could you do me a favor? I go, what's that? He goes, could you give me a reading list? I go, reading list? Joe, what the fuck? He goes, not for me. He goes, for Morrissey. He wants a list of Black writers who write about something other than just being Black. I was like, I am glad to give him a list. And I gave him a list to give to Morrissey. And I resisted any and all temptations to put Mein Kampf on the list. Because Hitler, after all, was not a Negro. So.
Well, there you have it. Eugene always with the clever repartee. Eugene, I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, but apparently a big theme on the record, and I definitely picked this up, especially with the last track, is the concept of sea, or the sea as a metaphor. So my first question is, do you like talking about the secret meetings or the artistic meanings behind your lyrics, or do you like to let people just make of it what they will?
No, it's it depends. We've had a certain type of interviewer, two, and I'm sure Nico would remember them, two in particular, a German guy and then a woman in San Francisco who now lives in Oregon. And they pulled from the MTV School of Interviewing, which is a reflexive self-promoting one, which is what they start off the interview with. I don't know anything about you. Tell me why you're cool. And, you know, as a journalist, of course, there's nothing that freezes me more, especially now with you being able to have access to the world through something like a search engine. Like, what do you don't? You're not going to get us on the show and like try to, you know, try to show that, you know, that there's a status difference between us, because after all, you don't know. And I just said, if you don't know who we are and what we do, why are we here? And she's like sputtering. Well, you know, I just wanted to. And with him, it was like the same thing. Well, I want you to tell me. I go, said, can you think of a better way to phrase that question? Because right now it sounds like you're trying to insult me. And, you know, it's hard to do that in the face of it, but your ignorance is no justification for it. Right. So, I like when somebody's tried, you know, because it gives me something. It gives me something to work with. And maybe the two of us could get together and figure out what I was saying. Right. I mean, because what I said is what I meant. But maybe my understanding of what I meant changes over time. And in this process of interviewing, like good journalism, we come to a new understanding of what it is that's happened. So that's my hope. But I'm not always interviewed by good journalists. So, you know, I end up answering the question I wish they had asked, and then hope that people can figure it out in the interim. But I don't mind talking about the lyrics. That's why we include them. We didn't include them on the first two records, you know, but we've done so since.
So then why is the sea sort of a recurring theme in this record?
You maybe should ask Carl Jung. How's that for a hint? You know, we talk about the collective unconscious and you know, I mean, if you start to have a lot of images of the sea in your dreams, I mean, it's a pretty short step to being able to figure out what I'm talking about. Right.
See, it's always a challenge interviewing Eugene because he's so well-read and knowledgeable. You could say, oh, so Eugene, what do you mean about this? And he'd be like, oh, you should refer to footnote 73 of, you know, Carl Jung's, you know, third book, you know. So Eugene is always an impressive guy. Nico, here's a question for you.
It's no mistake that my wife now has got her master's in philosophy. Because I've had other relationships with people who are like, why don't you just say what you fucking mean? And I'm like, my God, I am saying what I mean. You just don't understand it. Well, say it more simply. I can't, you know. So if I could, I would. I'm trying my best, right? So.
Well, there you have it. Nico, I love the second track on the album. It's called Icy White and Crystalline, or Crystalline. It's got an amazing riff and great lyrics and great delivery by Eugene. Nico, I guess, how important is the riff? Because I love the riff in that track. How important is the content of the riff to you?
The riff is something that we came up with at... there's my kids. Just when I start talking, the riff is something we did at rehearsal. It was an improv, and we. Yeah. All right, you know what? I gotta wait. I gotta get back to you. So ask Eugene a question. I'll come right back to you.
Well, Eugene, I think what we'll do is we'll play a track, and then we'll maybe hit some news if that's all right with you.
Yeah.
Just so the listeners know, Love's Holiday. I really dig it. July 21, the Ipecac. Also, Oxbow is going on tour. They're doing a short East Coast USA tour in October, I believe, and I'll definitely be there. And I believe you guys are also doing a UK tour in September, right? I think that's September, isn't it?
September 1st to September 16th, but it's more than the UK. It's UK, Germany, Denmark, you know, on and on. So Brussels, Belgium, yeah.
Glasgow, September 1, Leeds, September 3, Bristol, September 4, London, September 5, Belgium, September 7, and Bochum, Germany, September 10, and then East Coast in October. So I'm psyched for that. Eugene, what track should we play for the listeners to hear?
Well, why don't you play the one that you just talked about, Icy White and Crystalline.
That track is Kick Ass, and we will be right back.
go.
Oh,
is it possible to make this? And.
Let's hit a little bit of news, and I'll let you guys, I don't want to keep you guys too long because I know you guys all have a lot going on, but I would definitely like your perspective on a couple of things. The first thing that we're going to talk about is, so Liquid Death. Everybody knows Liquid Death. Liquid Death is this company that makes, it's actually, and it's literally just water in a can, and the marketing idea behind it is if you're at a bar and you don't want people to know that you're not drinking, you can just drink Liquid Death, which looks like it's a White Claw or something, but you're really just drinking water and no one knows, none of the wiser. So they've put out these albums that are basically, there are albums where known musicians read hateful comments about the product over some sort of music. So I guess there's two questions here, Eugene. What do you think of giving credence to internet trolls and giving them some sort of a platform, even if you're sort of mocking them? But also, in the 90s and the 80s, the big thing is you should never sell it because that perverts the art and you're not really being a true artist then. People sort of forgotten about that in the digital age now that no one makes any money on music at all, basically. So, Eugene, what's your perspective of working for a multinational million or even billion-dollar company and basically creating ads for them? What's your perspective on either of those things?
You know, we played Japan once and there's a healthy contingent of hardcore folks who kind of showed up. I mean, hardcore is still like a very serious thing in Japan. You know, we saw a lot of T-shirts to attest to this. And at one point, the interviewer asked us about selling out very specifically. And I said, you do realize, of course, that we are incapable of being anything other than oxbow, right? I mean, you know, Dylan said, and don't look back. He said, you know, I could sing better than Caruso if I wanted to. I just don't want to. And that's part of the problem with oxbow. We could do anything we wanted, but we just don't want to. We just want to do oxbow, which means if anybody were to come to us and give us a shitload of money to be oxbow, which I am right now, which I was yesterday, which I'll be tomorrow, would I be willing to take it? You know, you've introduced another twist to this. You say, okay, what they're paying you for in this instance is not to be oxbow, but to lend your brand to their shitty fucking product, in which you will do something like use your voice to read something that some jerk off on the internet said about their product for a piece of comedy. Okay. That's what you want. Okay. How much do you pay? And then it becomes like that Marx Brothers skit. He goes, I'm looking for some tough guys. You know, this is how much do you pay? He goes, well, what does that have to do with it? He goes, well, if you pay a little bit, we're a little tough. If you pay a lot, we're a lot tough. And then he said, okay, well, I pay plenty. Well, we're plenty tough. I mean, you want us to shill your fucking drink? How much is it worth to you? How much is it worth to you? Well, we'll give you $10,000. I have to tell you, honestly, that's not enough for me, you know? Well, how about we give you $100,000? Now we're starting to talk some real money. However, what I really want and what makes me really happy is agency. You know, I'm not saying something that's new for anybody. You feel happier. The higher your level of agency is, the better you feel. If you can go through your entire day not dancing to the tune played out by anybody else, by the end of that day, you're going to be pretty fucking happy. I didn't have to do anything I didn't want to today. So how do I get there? I get there through an ownership stake and the $100,000. Is that going to be acceptable to a company that just wants to show water in a can? Probably not, but I've named my price. There you go. I'm not passing judgment for people who do it for less, but that's my price. You know, you're not going to use me as a fucking chimp, you know, but I'm open to it. But you got to make me part of the structure, you know, make me part of it. So, I mean, I've worked at corporations over for the last 30 years, worked at Apple and Adobe and Nikon and Intel. So clearly I'm willing to be somebody's monkey, but it's what you pay for it and what you give me in return for it, right?
Nico, is there a product that you can see Oxbow supporting or being sponsored by?
Yeah. Yeah. And
you guitars. Know,
the short answer is, well, it's related to the way that the pendulum has swung right now, where, you know, intellectual property when it comes to music is worthless. This is something that irks me personally. And other people have different views. Other people in my band have different views, but I think the pendulum will swing back. I think that's a problem that we solved in the early 20th century through unions. So that affects the question that you asked. Like, I think it's fine for people that want to sell whiskey, that want to sell vodka, that want to, you know, do weird stuff that doesn't make any sense in order to survive. That's what it takes right now because of the pendulum swinging, because of all these things. I would prefer to sell guitars. I would prefer to sell something interesting. And to be involved in that kind of stuff. And fortunately, we spend a lot of money making our records and make very little of it back. And fortunately, we don't worry too much about that. We're going to still stay afloat and still have a roof over our heads and our kids get fed. So you name it, I'll think about it, because that's the way that musicians survive right now.
Well said. Speaking of agency, Cro-Mags have commented on the recent reissue of Best Wishes. Of course, the listeners probably know, last year, I believe it was, maybe it was the year before, Age of Quarrel got, quote, reissued. And the reissuer was basically a company that just licensed albums of all kinds, everything from jazz to pop to hip-hop to hardcore punk. They just licensed things and then put it out through distributors, basically. So it's kind of a on the cheap kind of a thing, and that, like, they know that if they press 5,000 copies of a record, the distributors will pick up all 5,000 copies and they'll make, you know, $30,000 off a $15,000 investment. However, Harley Flanagan has commented on the reissue of Best Wishes, like Age of Quarrel, saying that the Cro-Mags that were part of Best Wishes do not receive any money from the reissue, as it were, due to a contract they signed when they were, I don't know, 19, 20, 21, something like that, of legal age, but maybe not necessarily wise enough to know what they were signing. So, Eugene, have you ever had an experience where you've lost control of a record and people are using it without your consent? And also, this is not an uncommon scenario. Many artists, especially artists from the 60s, had this issue where they signed away everything when they were 18 or 19, and their records are all over the radio, but they're broke because they didn't know what they were signing with some 50-year-old guy that had three attorneys behind him. So I don't know, do you have a perspective? There you go. Eugene, do you have a perspective on the Cro-Mags issue? Should we have sympathy for Harley, or did he sign something and he should be held to that? What's your perspective?
Well, total disclosure, of course, you do know Harley is a good friend of mine. So
yes,
and in fact, he is. He had come. I'm no lawyer, as you yourself are, John. But he had come to me and said, at a certain point, before the whole thing with John Joseph, what do you think about them using the name and the band? I go, they're essentially licensing your band from you, and they should, if they want to do that, they should pay. But by no means should they be allowed to run off with this. So in regards to the contract thing, he hasn't sought my counsel in regards to the contract thing. But the best thing that Oxbow has ever done is always to term limit anything that we've ever signed. So that, you know, if it's a 10-year term, a 7-year term, any record label, if they're being truly aggressively honest, doesn't really expect to be pushing Oxbow Records that hard after the first 7 years. You know, at that point, it's just them collecting money. If you sign a contract that signs away your rights, you know, strict letter of the law guy, I'm like, you can contest this stuff in court if you've got the money. Laura, his wife, is an attorney, and, you know, which is how he ended up winning the judgment against John Joseph's version of the Cro-Mags. But I would, you know, if he's got the money and the time and the inclination, I would push him to do this, especially since qualitatively, which seems to be his gripe, it's of lower quality. Now, we had a very similar, not similar, we had a situation where we had a separation, a falling out with a label. This is in the olden days. And I found out that the record label was still selling through a distributor that was based in San Francisco. And I ended up contacting the distributor and go, you got to stop. And they go, you have got no grounds to tell us to stop. I said, if somebody broke into my house and stole my TV that you were then turning around and attempting to sell, I might have a case. You know, I don't know if I have a case in a court of law, but I would certainly have a casus belli for when I see you on the street next. And the guy was like, you're being unreasonable. I go, I don't think I am. He goes, how many records do you think Oxbow sells? I go, that's not the point. The point is this guy's robbing us from overseas and you're helping him. So that makes you an enemy. And the guy goes, okay, I'll stop selling your record. You see, we'll see how good this does for you. And whatever, you know, we stopped selling the record. That's all I needed to have happen. Where am I in the case law on that? Well, I guess I committed extortion and, and threats of bodily violence in a very subtle way. But, you know, in that instance, I mean, you should, who knows what'll happen if you say, look, my issue is not that you guys do it, but that the quality is cheap. Maybe they put more. I mean, you gotta stand up. You gotta push back a little. You might come to nothing, but you know, nothing from nothing gets nothing. So try, give it a try.
I mentioned this in pretty much every newsletter that I put out through my firm, is there's a thing called copyright termination. And very roughly speaking, and all artists should know this, and every artist should do this, is with between your 35 and 40, in the vast majority of record label contracts and any contract regarding intellectual property, you can terminate, which basically means between your 35 and 40, so long as you do a very specific filing of a specific paper and give specific notice, you can get your record back for free. And I can't tell you the number of punk bands I've reached out to, and actually, I don't want to name them, but there's an amazing hip hop artist I've reached out to a bunch of times, and he's always complaining, I don't own my first record. I'm like, you can own your first record in 2 years, and they all, not all of them, but they more often than not seem disinterested. And I can't fathom why. You complain that you don't have your record, but I can get it back for you. And I just don't understand that idea. Now, I'm not saying that's the case with the Cro-Mags. I don't know anything about the Cro-Mags, but I think it's actually messier than that. But I'm just saying, just so artists know, between year 35 and 40, you can get your record back for free. So you should do that if you have a record license. Let's see.
I tried for years to get those guys back together because I was friendly with John Joseph and with Harley. And I was like, you guys are leaving so much fucking money on the table. And, you know, why don't you just, and actually Harley was open to it. But John Joseph at one point after like the third or fourth phone call said, Eugene, I love you. You're well-meaning, but this is never gonna happen. And I was like, okay, what can you do? I tapped out. Yeah.
We're getting a little off track here, but reunions, are reunions ever really worthwhile? I'm thinking about the Misfits reunion. That was actually pretty kick-ass, but then sometimes it just kind of falls flat. Eugene, there's so much animosity between Harley and John Joseph. Do you think a reunion show would be really cool, or do you think it would be kind of by the numbers?
No, it would be great. It would be great. They would forget, you know, once you get on stage, you would forget. But I think the deal is, I remember at one point in the old days with Whipping Boy, we had a bass player who like had no place to live. He was like, had lived in his car. And finally I said, man, you should come move into our house. Nico already lived there. I was living there. And he rented a room where they rented a closet out to him. So he put a shelf in the closet and slept on the shelf in a closet. And I said, how is it you would rather live in a closet than get a room in my house? And he just looked at me and goes, frankly, Eugene, I got to tell you, I don't want to live with somebody who can beat me up. What's that? You grew up in a house with a father, you know, when you're a kid, your father could beat you up. He goes, yeah, and I didn't like that. So I said, you'd rather sleep in a closet. You know, I'm not going to beat you up. I've never beat you up before. He didn't like it. And I think with John Joseph and Harley, I think the issue is that after John punched Harley and ran, you know, Harley's subsequently become a very dangerous guy. I mean, a black belt in jiu-jitsu is nothing to scoff at. So I think the power imbalance bothers him. I don't know. I'm guessing. I don't know. I don't know his motivations.
Well, I appreciate the insight. I got to say, the last few Harley albums, especially the one called Harley Flanagan, Cro-Mags, amazing album, so people check that out. Let's change topics. We got a few, actually two last quick stories. Nico, I'm going to throw this one to you. Bad Cop, which is a pop punk band that everyone loves at Punk News, they canceled their Ireland shows. The reason they canceled them was that they said high travel costs, but they also added lower than expected ticket sales, which I was usually when a band cancels a tour, they're like, oh, production or oh, visa issues or something. Here they were like, we're just not selling enough tickets. Nico, is it cool to be honest to your audience about ticket sales, or should you lie in order to, I guess, preserve your stock for the next tour?
Yeah, you say, I want to spend more time with my family. That's it. Yeah. You know, we just had this discussion within Oxbow a couple days ago. And I didn't actually respond to that conversation because I was in the minority. And my thinking on things like that is this, that I prefer honesty as a consumer. When I pay attention to bands, I want them to be honest with me for this, the reason that once somebody starts not telling the truth, and we learn this as children, it's a slippery slope. And, you know, fabrication, it's a little bit better than it was. And that drives me crazy because then I can't trust anything they say. And I think there's something as, okay, so why is that important in art? Because, you know, yes, art is the lie that tells the truth. But at some point, you want to have the ability to discern between the truth and not truth. And it just regarding the ticket sales, I think that's actually, they probably did it because they wanted to be honest and they wanted to, you know, the word that comes to mind is endearing. They wanted people to feel some pity for them, and you know, that sort of thing. I think that's okay. There's a million other things they could have said. I would think that they probably thought about it. It's kind of distasteful. It's like, ugh. And they for sure, I actually read that news article, and at the end they said, well, we sold out these other shows and everything's like, you know, A1 top notch and the rest of the tour. I'm not making fun of them, but like, they're very clear to say that the rest of it is good. So, you know, I think that's okay. But I definitely see the other side of that as well.
I myself like the transparency. You know, we at one point, I don't know if you remember, on Thin Black Duke, we spent so much money on it that we decided to do a GoFundMe. People could choose to give money or not in lieu of actually people paying for the records. And some people tried to lambast and say, it's your fault you spent the money. We're not talking about faults. At this point now, we're standing at the freeway off ramp with a bag of oranges in our hands out. You can drive on by or you can put some coin in our hands. It'll make a difference. And I think we were at, I think we got about $14,000 of people who were given money for the record, which might sound like a lot until you consider that we spent easily four times that amount on Thin Black Duke. So I like transparency. And the lack of transparency has fucked me up more times than I care. There's a guy, and he's in a very popular band, and I don't need to mention. And at one point, he was telling me about his life. And he's got a really nice house in a really nice city. He's got five kids. And I'm like doing the math in my head. And I said, so this is really paying out for you. And he looks at me and he says, no, man, it's T-shirts. I go, T-shirts? He goes, yeah, I'm working through Shirt Killer and this other company. You know, we move like 20,000 of these 30,000 shirts through Hot Topic. I go, what the fuck? That many people know about your band? He goes, no, you're missing the point. People at Hot Topic don't know anything about the band. They're just buying the shirts because they like the design. And it just seems like, oh, shit, so you guys have become textile. I got it. And I'm excited about it. And I was talking to another friend of mine from Neurosis, and he said, and he's just watching me, and he gets that look on his face like, Eugene, you poor, sad, stupid son of a bitch. He doesn't say that, but that's what the look says. And then finally he says, hey, man, you do know dude's got family money. I go, what? He goes, he's got family, the house, the wife who doesn't work, the five kids. He's got family money. Didn't you know that? I was like, God damn, I'm about to invest everything in T-shirts. You know, I'm about to let it all ride on T-shirts until I find this out. So I work a lot better with transparency. Or alternatively, I had a girlfriend once who told me, I trust you will tell me everything I need to know, which I thought was probably the most genius thing. She didn't say, don't have sex with other women. She didn't say, I'm not saying don't do, you know, she just said, get the step over all that. I trust that you will tell me whatever I need to know. And that was wonderful. I would expect at least that from other bands. Don't lie to me about T-shirts.
Well, they have it. Last, I guess, question for today, then we'll wrap this up. Nick Cave and Debbie, we talked about Nick Cave actually earlier on this podcast, but Nick Cave and Debbie Harry released a cover of On the Other Side by Gun Club's Jeffrey Lee Pierce. That's off the fourth tribute album to Jeffrey Lee Pierce, and it's called The Task Has Overwhelmed Us, which is out September 29. Also, one of my favorite iconic late 70s, early 80s rockers, Billy Idol, is re-releasing his first record that comes with a bonus live album. I think the whole thing is remixed, remastered. So I guess I'll throw it to you, both of you. Do you guys have any good Debbie Harry, Nick Cave, Jeffrey Lee Pierce, or Billy Idol stories? or if not, what's your stance on Billy Idol? Some people think he's a cheesy pop star. Other people think he's an original OG punk rocker. I just think he's a great musician, and I like that he wrote it for the Sex Pistols.
Yeah, I'm more of the latter. I think he's got a really amazing voice, and he's made some great, great songs. I mean, the Gen X stuff is fucking great. And I remember listening to that stuff and thinking, wow, he could really do something. He could have a great career. And there, you know, he has, which is good. He's a really good singer, in tune and rough. And so whatever he wants to do is fine with me. I listened to that Nick Cave and Debbie Harry song, and it's fascinating to me, you know, their voices, whatever they've done to her voice, she has such a beautiful tone, and just talking production wise, I didn't really dig them together. So Nick Cave does that thing with pitch, and he's got this super honest delivery, which I really like. I like Nick Cave's interesting music, good lyrics, and her singing thing is so different, and they didn't work together. It was a little bit like Metallica. You know, right? You know what I'm talking about. Lulu. So, Lulu. So, you know, but they're fine. Yep.
Well, I'm guessing that you asked this question because you know about my past with Nick Cave.
I don't know about your past with Nick Cave. That's why I'm asking.
Okay. So Barry Adamson says, listen, Eugene, I want you to come. I'm doing the London Jazz Festival at Royal Albert Hall, and I want you to come and sing a song, right? Okay. You got a budget? He's like, yeah, I got a budget. So they fly me over, put me up in a hotel, and I'm singing Romeo Is Bleeding, right? And Cave is on the show, which I don't really know right away. But this big band, he's got like a 16-piece band. And Barry is a nice guy, but he's not that nice of a guy. Like, you know, I've heard beforehand, like one of the guitar players came over from France and he fired the guy on the spot. The guy wasn't grooving. Go back. So I, you know, I was a certain amount of gripping. And, but, you know, cause Nick Cave, it's his idol status for me. And so he's there, we're in the green room and I'm not being an ass. I'm not talking. He says, okay, Eugene, you come out at a rehearsal. Sing the song. So I sing the song, Romeo Is Bleeding. It's a Tom Waits tune. And I didn't do it a Tom Waits style, right? I don't want to do that. I want to do it like I would do it. And I'm also conscious of the fact that Nick Cave is watching. So I was like, yeah, okay. All right. I'm going to give you a little bit of oxbow, right? So I fucking kill it in my estimation. I kill it, right? And he's like, yeah, the guys in the band are like, oh, cool. We were hoping that you wouldn't do some cheesy jazz bow thing like Tom Waits. You just made it your own. I go, right. I walk backstage and Cave is there. And he's like, yeah, that's not too bad. I go, ah, yeah, thank you. Thank you. You know, and I say some bullshit about the stage and the mic and stuff. But really the look that we're exchanging in the eyes are like, okay, it's on. So he goes out and he rehearses Next by Scott Walker, originally from the Jacques Brel tune. And he, so it's like Escaladio, it's building, like he kills it. I was like, all right, okay, I got you. It's on. I go back to the hotel, put on a nice suit, come back. The whole fucking thing is sold out. And he said, okay, you know, I get my cue. I go out and I you know, just rip up the stage. All these people, they don't know oxbow from shit. They don't know who the fuck I am. They don't know. The guys in the band are all excited. And I kill it by my estimation. And of course, Barry, who did not fire me, is really excited about it. And Cave looks at me and he's like, all right. And it's time for him to go on and do his song. And he goes out and just delivers the most fucking greatest version of Next ever. And so we're both backstage, like, and he's with Susie. And we're both just kind of geeked afterward, like you are, left a good show. And I go, oh, fuck, man. You know, that was great. Oh, I'm so glad to be able to work with you. I said, you know, it'd be really cool if we did this again next time. And like you actually did it in French, that would be fucking great. And he pauses and he looks at me and he kind of goes, huh. Walks off, never spoke to me again. I was like, oh. I didn't mean to. I don't hang around with fashion people. I don't know. Did I overstep my? Was that? I'm not. Ah, man. I'm sorry. I did it. I don't know. So, but that's a special skill I have, saying the exact wrong thing at probably the exact right time. I still stand by that. That would have been a fucking blast, you know, for him to come out and say, like, have you ever heard the George Michael stuff that he sings in other languages?
I have not, no.
He does a great job. It's really phenomenal. So,
well, there you have it. Eugene and Nico, humble, but I would say confident and adventurous and just charming as always. So, fellas, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. The new record, I know I said it a bunch of times before, but I really mean it. I mean, this record, Love's Holiday, July 21, via Ipecac. It is great. It is really great. Like I said, I love the second track that we played. Fellas, to be on the show, should we send them out with another new tune, an old tune, or a tune by someone else? What do you guys want to send them out with?
Let Nico pick it, because I picked the last one. So let Nico pick it.
What'd you pick for the last one?
Icy White and Crystalline, because he had just talked about it. So I figured that was good.
Yep. Geez.
Performance pressure.
Yeah. What about... you know, punk rock. What if you did the third track on Thin Black Duke. Is it Time Gentleman or a Gentleman's Gentleman? Gentleman's Gentleman.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Okay, this is Gentleman's Gentleman by Oxbow, and we'll see you all next week. And Eugene and Nico, thanks again.
Hey, thanks, you, John. Man. It's great talking.
Thanks.